Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, winner of every major award in its field. Today's guest on Meet the Press will be Walter W. Heller, one of the nation's leading economists, formerly chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. We'll bring you today's program in a moment.
This is Frank Blair, your Sunday night monitor host. Are vampire bats for real, or do they just exist in fiction? We get the answer to this from Ray Polly, curator of the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago, a recent guest on Sunday Night Monitor.
Well, a vampire bat in fiction is probably about the size of you or I. In reality, the little devil is probably 4 inches tall, and when he spreads his wings out, he could probably span the distance of your hand. Well, this animal does just exactly what these mythical animals were supposed to do. This bat has evolved to a point where he lives off of the blood of victims. The bat actually very surreptitiously tries to creep in, nip an animal while the animal is sleeping at night, and then laps up the blood as it flows. The saliva of the bat prevents the blood from coagulating, so he can lap up a pretty good meal and then take off.
Come join us on Sunday Night Monitor. You'll be glad you did.
A boy can depend on his mother when he's young, but if he's mentally retarded, he may have to depend on her for a lifetime. This doesn't have to be. With special training, he can become independent, even to the point of earning his own living. The National Association for Retarded Children helps obtain this training for those youngsters who need it. Please send your contribution to your local unit of the National Association for Retarded Children. Thank you. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest, one of the country's leading economists, Walter W. Heller. Our panel consists of Hobart Rowan of Newsweek, Edwin Dale of the New York Times, Richard Harkness, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak, producer of Meet the Press. Ned Brooks is our moderator.
Now we'll have the first question from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Dr. Heller, the government yesterday criticized the aluminum price increase as unjustified and inflationary. Do you think the price increase was unjustified?
Yes, I do, under the government's wage price guideposts.
In spite of the fact that the aluminum prices today are lower than in 1958 and aluminum earnings on invested capital lower than many other industries?
Well, I don't think the price that existed in the past is a necessary guide to the price that should exist today. I don't think we should say, for example, that the color TV sets that people are looking through today should rise back to the price they did earlier. The point is that some industries have more rapid increases in productivity than others. And if we're going to have overall price stability, some prices have to go down or hold steady, while other prices, where productivity rises more slowly, go up. And here's a case where profits have risen rapidly, 80% since 1960, 33% since last year, where costs per unit of output have been going down. And it's a very basic industry in our economy. And consequently, I think that there is a relatively strong case for holding prices where they are rather than raising them. And the argument that they once were higher is, in this case, it seems to me, not relevant.
Why do you think the price increase would have been inflationary or would be inflationary?
Well, in effect, it's this, that if our price decisions in this economy of ours reflect productivity increases, it will mean that some prices, as I say, have to go down, others will go up, in order to hold an overall stable level. And here's a case where the productivity facts and the profits facts really call for a holding steady, I won't say a decrease in the previous price. And consequently, if it goes up, it will contribute to an overall rise in the price level. And, of course, this isn't the only issue that's at stake. It seems to me that we have a very basic issue. We've had a winning combination of good private policy and good public policy, which has produced a long-standing prosperity. And an absolute essential of that has been the fine, productive performance of private industry and their moderation in inventories and finance, and particularly their moderation in prices. And it seems to me unless we maintain that, we threaten the whole fabric of expansion.
If you had been chairman, would you have recommended the policy that the government finally adopted in this case?
Well, it's always hard to put yourself in someone else's shoes, but it seems to me that given this economic issue of maintaining expansion, given the public interest, and given an increasing moral issue involving the fact that 300,000 to 400,000 tons of aluminum is being used or will be used next year in connection with Vietnam, yes, I think I would have taken the same position.
Well, now, what effect will the government's marketing of 200,000 tons of aluminum have on aluminum prices, in your judgment, next year?
Well, I think that if, unless the law of supply and demand has been repealed, it will tend to hold prices below what they otherwise would have been. That's all one can say. I couldn't predict the exact effect, but it does seem to me that the addition of 200,000 tons will tend to hold prices in the aluminum industry.
We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Dale.
Dr. Heller, you and other advocates of the new economics have always said that the government could safely stimulate the economy through higher spending or lower taxes, safely, without inflation, as long as there were idle men and idle plant. But wouldn't you agree that there has been inflation this year? Shoes are up, clothing is up, meat is up. Now we have aluminum. We had copper before that. Hasn't there been inflation this year?
Well, let's put it this way, Mr. Dale. The price creep has accelerated somewhat. And I'm sure the housewife who buys meats in the market is well aware of this. But overall, what's happened is that instead of rising at about 1.3% a year, the consumer price index rose 1.7% the past year. A good part of that was in the in a temporary rise in food, which has been receding again. And I don't think we're yet seeing, in spite of the fact that you're quite right, we have less margin of unused resources. We are closer to our full potential. I don't think we're yet seeing what you could honestly call an inflationary breakout.
Well, now, looking ahead to next year, I believe you've suggested that the next federal budget would be in the range of $107 to $110 billion. Does that estimate still look good?
Well, this was an estimate made without benefit of any inside information, simply as I read what Vietnam will cost, as I read what the new the Great Society programs will cost and the normal growth of the population and so forth. I would say that for fiscal 1967, the fiscal year starting next July 1, a figure in the neighborhood of 7 or 8 billions, 107, 108 is not out of range.
Well, now, if that's true, with the economy already operating much closer to full capacity, wouldn't such a large increase in federal outlays be inflationary next year?
No, indeed, it would not. You forget, although you shouldn't, having written an article in today's one of today's major newspapers, that the revenues of the federal government rise by $7 billion a year just automatically from the growth of the economy, and a rise in the budget to that level would not even absorb all the increase in revenues.
Mr. Rowan.
Dr. Heller, price stability has been a major, if not the major, objective of the government for the last 3 or 4 years, 4 or 5, I should say. Has the time come when we should accept a certain measure of creeping inflation in order to assure full employment? Should these goals be equalized?
Well, Mr. Rowan, I don't think we need to. In other words, sure, it's true that there are more businessmen with their fingers on the price trigger today, and it's also true that we have a diminishing margin of unused resources. But we have a lot of defenses against inflation, too. We have an enormous growth of good productive capacity. And you know, the 1,500,000 new workers come onto the market each year, into the labor market, and better educated than ever. As far as cost push is concerned, we have had virtually stable unit costs. There's intense competition. So capacity, cost, competition, they're all working for us. No, I don't think we're at that point.
Well, let me put the question in a slightly different way then. When the interim goal of 4% unemployment was set, we were then close to 7% unemployment. We're now down to 4.3%. Do you think the time has come, should it be a matter of national policy, to try to achieve a goal of less than 4%? How far below that can we get, and how far should we try to get?
Well, Mr. Ron, you know, way back in our first economic report in the Kennedy administration in January of 1962, we said it is time to begin now to plan to get below 4%. In other words, 4% is the level where you have a pretty good standoff between the forces of inflation, shall we say, and the forces of expansion, of employment. But by manpower programs, training, retraining, poverty programs, etc., you can push that below 4% in the course of time, not overnight.
Would you now set a goal, though, Dr. Heller, of getting to a rate below 4% as national policy? Is it time in next year's economic report to set this figure?
Well, whether we set a specific figure or not, it's certainly time to work in terms of a figure below 4%. Yes, I would agree.
Mr. Harkness.
Doctor, you've been using phrases here like price creep and cost push. Let me ask you this. Suppose I have $5,000 or $10,000 to invest. This admittedly is a very iffy question, Doctor. Do I hedge against inflation by buying stocks or real estate? Do I hedge against deflation? Put my money in bonds? What would you do with $5,000 or $10,000 now?
Well, what I would do with $5,000 or $10,000, and I don't want to say what I have done with $5,000 or $10,000. Well, mainly I've paid off debts, but what I would do is this. I would pick a good, solid company, piece of property, and invest on the assumption that basically this economy of ours is going to have a lot more expansion in the past than in the future than it's had in the past, and I would not bet on any inflationary breakout. I'm not saying the price creep won't continue. I'm not saying it might not even accelerate a bit. But I do not look for any substantial inflation in the months and years to come. I would not program my individual investments on that basis, nor on deflation.
Doctor, we hear about another $7 billion for Vietnam in the next budget. Can we afford guns and the Great Society?
Well, within reason, within measure. In other words, we can't satisfy all our aspirations at once. I should think that the demands of Vietnam, if they stick to, let's say, a $5 to $7 billion add-on to the federal budget, would permit substantial advances along the Great Society programs. Not as fast as those of us who are more impatient would like, and the president will have a tough time balancing these things so it stays within the economy's non-inflationary capacity. But I think we can have both at the present scale of operations.
Right along that line, the president's current budget's slightly under $100 billion, but we discovered that Congress actually voted $119 billion this last session. Is there any check rein on government spending?
Oh, yes, indeed. That's one of the things that... first of all, let's say the $119 billion is obligational authority. That's not cash on the barrel head.
No, but it will be spent.
But in the course of time, it enables the government agencies to plan ahead and obligate those funds. But I would say this budget is definitely under control. Under President Johnson, there is no question about it that we have a budgetary approach and a budgetary technique, and under Charles Schulz, the budget director, the same thing, where there's a real rigid termination of priorities. I'm not saying all waste is gone. I'm saying that we are not in danger of having our budget run out of control.
You have a control except for Vietnam, isn't that right?
Well, but even there, I think that unless that breaks out way beyond what is now thought to be the case, that's under control, too.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Heller, I've been reading conflicting and in some ways confusing predictions about the expected state of our economy in the months ahead. Will you give us your most conservative prophecy for 1966 or for whatever period you can see ahead?
Well, of course, all my prophecies are conservative. I would think that the best bet is an economy expanding a little bit less slowly than this year, but still at about a pace of $10 billion per quarter in current dollar terms. And that would mean a GNP of $710, $711 billion for next year. That, I think, is one's best guess at the present time. And that's just a tiny bit less of a real advance than we've had this year.
Do you still think that we're going to reach a gross national product of $700 billion by the middle of next year? I think that's what you once predicted.
Yes, I do. I think we'll cross that line in the second quarter of next year, somewhere between $700 and $707 billion, I'd say, in the second quarter of next year.
I'd like to ask you a question about the stock market. I think you've spoken about that once before. What danger, if any, do you see in the increased stock market activity and the constantly rising prices?
Well, Mr. Spivak, I'd never like to see a market where prices bounce up and down as much as $10, $15 a day. And I never like to predict the stock market because that takes not just analysis but psychoanalysis. But I would say this, that the market has a very solid underpinning of profits. That is to say, our profits today, after taxes of corporations, are running $44.5 billion. That's an 80% increase over 1961, and it's about a 33% increase since the tax cut. The price-earnings ratios are, while high, not really rising. I look at the underlying factors, and I don't know what the market will do, but the underlying factors, I find, are strong.
Professor Galbraith, Kenneth Galbraith suggested the other day that margins ought to be increased to very close to 100%. Are you in favor of that?
Well, that's a very tough question, and people who are closer to the market than I would have to judge that in terms of how much speculative activity they think is entering in to these current rising and falling prices. I would hesitate to make that judgment.
Mr. Dale.
Dr. Heller, you suggested in New York a few days ago that the 64 tax cut may have worked too well, and I gather what you meant was it might create too much temptation to do another one. Is that what you had in mind?
Well, not exactly. All I'm saying is that when we declare future fiscal dividends out of this $7 billion a year that accrues to the Federal Treasury, we should give full weight to the other claimants on those dividends, not just tax cuts, but maybe some sharing with the state governments of some of the revenues. Maybe we should substitute some of the income tax for the payroll tax on Social Security. Social Security payroll taxes raise costs. They're tough on the lower income groups, and I'm not sure we should cut federal income taxes a great deal while we're boosting payroll taxes all the time.
Well, in general, as a philosophical matter, do you think we're now at a stage in this country where, as again Galbraith suggests, that we should definitely use the fiscal dividend for public expenditure purposes rather than tax cuts?
Well, fortunately, you know, we don't have to make an absolute choice. With $35 billion of additional revenues accruing between now and 1970, of course, they're spoken for next year, so there are no tax cuts in sight for 1966. But with that much revenue accruing, there's no reason that we can't have some further tax cuts. I would certainly feel that there's room for those, plus a very substantial strengthening of the programs that make a society great, that make us enjoy our great wealth and growth and gross national product and not suffer through it, so to speak.
In that connection, your name has been associated with the Heller plan for turning back a part of the federal income tax to the states virtually without strings, and I guess you've just conceded that it's not on for next year because our revenues are all spoken for. When do you believe that could become a practicable possibility?
Well, I think that so much depends on the other pressing needs to which you've referred. Such things also as whether we decide to have an anti-missile program, which would cost $20 billion. In other words, is an iffy question, but I think it's the kind of a question, and the question of the form of stronger support for the states, and support that not only strengthens their finances, but strengthens their independence. It's the kind of a question we should be looking at for 1967 and 1968. And I would only add that there are many different ways of doing it, and it isn't that the federal government hasn't been increasing its help to the states. It's gone up from $3 to $13 billion in 10 years. It seems to me we should consider the claims of the states in any fiscal dividends we declare.
Mr. Rowan.
Dr. Heller, I'd like to come back to aluminum. You told Mr. Spivak earlier that a price increase wasn't justified simply because it had once been higher. How about the industry's argument that it needs a price increase because its return on capital investment has been lagging behind other industries.
Well, I've taken a look at that, Mr. Rowan, and I find that their capital return is running, as I figure it, close to 10%, around 9.9%. Now, that's a little bit below average, but certainly we wouldn't argue that all industries have to be on the average. There are some industries with less risk, others with more, and so on. So I don't think that's a good argument. I don't think in this case that it's by any means a decisive argument. And I might add one other thing. Their total cash flow exceeds anything they've had in history.
Well, since there seem to be some arguments on both sides of the case, one wonders whether or not the strong words that Mr. Ackley used yesterday in condemning the price increase were meant to be as well a general warning to all of industry that inflation might be a problem.
Well, I think it's simply underscoring the fact that industry has made really a great contribution to this expansion by these policies that I alluded to earlier, by increasing its productivity, by holding prices, and that this does carry within it the seeds of breaking that up, because if our balance of payments is worsened by importing too much of aluminum, if our price level starts moving up, then we've got to cut back.
Well, now, you lived through the Kennedy-Blau confrontation in 1962. Do you see that the fight over aluminum contains within it the seeds for breaking up the consensus that President Johnson has achieved with business?
I don't really think so. There is a parallel in one respect, namely in both cases, the president is representing and stating the public interest, or the president and his administration. But I think the understanding between the president and the business community and the facts of life, namely $44.5 billion of profits, are good, hard evidence of the desire of this administration to cooperate with business and to have prosperous business. But that takes, the partnership is a two-way affair, and the public interest deserves some recognition in the decisions of as important an industry as the aluminum industry, where 80% of total production is controlled by three companies.
Gentlemen, we have about 3 minutes remaining. Mr. Harkness.
Doctor, this aluminum controversy seems to be just an installment. There was, as Mr. Rowan just mentioned, President Kennedy's crackdown on steel prices. Then Mr. Johnson virtually approved, if not dictated, the recent steel labor agreement, which seemed to me to have selective price rise inherent. Are we seeing a new type, a new form of government control over big business and its economics?
Well, I think there is a stronger assertion of what the public responsibility and public interest of private business really is. But let me assure you that this administration, and I know this from many conversations with the people involved, abhor direct controls. They don't want direct controls over prices or wages or excess profits.
You're saying we have indirect federal controls then?
Well, I don't really even call them indirect controls. I think it's a pointing out of where the public interest lies, and not only that, but where the long-run self-interest of industry lies. And as I say, I think there's also the moral issue. With power and freedom go responsibility. And particularly when we're fighting a war in Vietnam, it seems to me this is underscored.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Heller, according to reports, our balance of payments deficit will be cut this year from $3.1 billion to about $1.3 billion. Is that enough?
No.
To solve the problem?
No. First of all, we have to continue it, and secondly, we have to get it down even somewhat more. It's not something that we can be complacent about.
We can accomplish the job through voluntary methods?
Yes, I do. I think that we have provided an excellent base in terms of American productivity and costs that have been falling. We've increased exports 25% since 1960. They've come back strong in the third quarter of this year. And I think that, plus the voluntary program, to which there's really been a magnificent response by banking and on volatile funds by business.
You would be against mandatory controls
at this
time.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there is no contemplation of mandatory controls by this administration.
Mr. Dale.
I understand now that you are a banker. Do you feel there is any danger to the economy in the rising trend of interest rates at the moment, particularly as reflected in the bond markets?
Well, I'd put it this way. If we boosted the discount rate, the Federal Reserve discount rate, above 4%, which, by the way, would be the highest rate in 35 years, there would be danger, because that would move out into the mortgage markets, which in housing is already weak. It would move out into long-run investment. Yes, I would not tighten beyond the point where we are.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. In just a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview. How can you express in terms of money the work that health services do in caring for the sick, or what family services do in keeping families together, or youth services in helping boys and girls grow up? Just the same, it takes money to keep these health and welfare agencies going. And through your United Fund or Community Chest, you also help children and the elderly. Many United campaigns support Red Cross and USO and medical research, too. Give the United way.
Charlie?
Yes, old learned one?
What does the golden age of radio mean to you?
Oh, bigger allowance than I'm getting now.
No, Charlie, what about comedians?
Oh, they used to be funny.
Remember Fred Allen?
Fred was funny.
Yes, Fred was funny.
Yes, and there were many of us. Yeah.
On Sunday evening, November 14th, you and I are going back. Back to the golden age of radio. Great moments from the original Fred Allen radio shows of the 30s and 40s.
You know, I was getting 75 cents a week in those days.
I know, Charlie. Fred's guests will include Bing Crosby, Tallulah Bankhead, Beatrice Lilly, Oscar Levant, Jack Benny, Leo DeRocher, Georgie Jessel, and the Allen's Alley actors. So plan to enjoy the humor of Fred Allen with Charlie and me for one special sparkling hour on Sunday night, November the 14th, over your local NBC radio station.
You know something, Bagging?
What, Charlie?
I'm still getting 75 cents a week. I could do better going on relief.
Now, more details on Meet the Press. Today's guest was Walter W. Heller, one of the nation's leading economists. And the panel consisted of Edwin Dale of the New York Times, Hobart Rowan of Newsweek, Richard Harkness, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak, producer of Meet the Press. America's future rests with our young people. To make the future strong, we must provide our young people with the kind of education they need for effective lives. Citizens everywhere are joining together in efforts to provide dollars for scholars. Find out how they are doing it and how you can do it in your community for your students. Write today for Dollars for Scholars, a free pamphlet to help you and your neighbors get started. Write to Citizenship Scholarship Foundation, Box 362, Fall River, Massachusetts. Look around at the next park or recreation area you visit. Is it neat and clean and litter-free? If it isn't, it's time to remember what Susan Spotless says: every litter bit hurts. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C. Meet the Press will be heard again next week at this same time, when our guests will be Governor John Chafee of Rhode Island and Governor Philip H. Huff of Vermont, who have returned from a trip to the Far East, including South Vietnam, as representatives of the National Governors Conference.
McCarthy's the name, and comedy's the game on Sunday night, November the 14th, when this NBC radio station presents great moments from the original Fred Allen radio shows.